Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting radio-exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.
When your company earns unlimited 2% cash back on all purchases with Capital One, that's serious business. So, Steven at SandCloud got a serious business card. The Spark Cash Plus card from Capital One.
We used our 2% cash back to help build our retail presence.
Savvy, Steven.
And we get big purchasing power, so our business can spend more and earn more.
The Spark Cash Plus card from Capital One. What's in your wallet?
Terms and conditions apply. Find out more at CapitalOne.com/SparkCashPlus.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn. And you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting radio-exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.
Drivers who switch and save with Progressive could save hundreds. With that kind of money, you could go big time on a fancy water bottle with ultra-titanium alloy metal. You're not sure why you need all that. I mean, it just holds water. But you're getting it anyway. Because if you're hiking near an active volcano and you accidentally drop the bottle into molten lava, your water will still be icy cold. Switch to Progressive and you could save big time. For water bottles. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and affiliates. Not available in all states. Potential savings will vary.
This is the Hidden Killers podcast with Tony Bruschi and continuing coverage of the case against Karen Reed.
Well, another week and we're off to a very interesting start, so to speak, as we're talking about the trial of Karen Reed and new witnesses taking the stand, a whole new chapter beginning. Joining us to discuss, Jennifer Coffendaffer, retired FBI special agent. Yeah, I mean, I want to talk about some of what happened last week since we last talked as well, but I just want to dive in right away with some of the stuff that we're seeing on Monday morning as you and me are having this conversation. Kelly, and I know she already corrected Ellen Jackson on the stand. Dever? I forget what she said it correctly because I'm horrible with names, but she was up there, a former Canton PD officer who had been around the case but never was involved directly in any way, shape, or form. She was asked shortly after, not shortly after, quite a ways after, you know, what do you remember of the day being at the building with the Sally Port? She thought she remembered them being there, but then later looked at the timestamps and went, yeah, actually, my cruiser, I would have been physically gone by then. So it was a false memory, which, you know, if you think about and everybody's going, oh, it's a big lie. You know what? You have a lot more false memories than you actually are aware of, especially in situations like that. Jennifer, that's going to be the big thing that people are going to be honing in on the side of Karen Reed. How would you argue that?
You know, I'm going to go brick and mortar on this.
Yeah.
Just facts. He wasn't there.
We know that
end
for
of story.
A fact. Yep.
I can't believe she it was even called to the stand.
Yeah.
And, you know, at the end of the day, this this officer was so wet behind the ears, so very green. Basically, she wasn't called on to do anything but man the dispatch center, which basically she didn't even remember there were cameras there.
Mm-hmm.
She was later told about cameras being there. That's what she said. She said through the media, she found out there were cameras there. And then she was later interviewed and kind of, you know, falsely recollected Berkowitz, not even Trooper Proctor, but Berkowitz and Higgins being in there, not them doing anything, but quote unquote being wildly in there for a wildly long time before they left. Only the issue was she wasn't even there.
Yeah.
So it's so moot now. If they were doing a case against her, you know, some sort of internal inquiry, that would be relevant. I absolutely see no relevance here, and the fact that she said that Alan Jackson asked her to lie. I mean, that's a quote.
Yeah.
He asked me to lie. He wanted me to lie. He wanted me to not tell the truth. I think it's going to play really bad, especially when we're going to be into ARCA before you know it. And all of that is going to come out. Signal, the lies, the misrepresentations. It's going to look bad.
Yeah. And that's a big thing here. I was like, well, this didn't work out very well. And again, I both sides I know are arguing, see, but I at the end of the day, just looking at this, it didn't play well for the defense of Karen Reed, just by way, I think, of the Kelly's comments that she would make that weren't necessarily directly an answer to Alan Jackson's questions. The context that she added in really felt quite damning to Karen, especially when she was talking about that they were quite upset when she's like, look, I couldn't have been there. It was a false recollection. And then she allegedly says that Alan Jackson threatened her to go after her with perjury, tried to play that down when she was on the stand. But she looked into it. She actually contacted the FBI, which I thought was another interesting line of the day of, oh, you really looked into this because you thought this was really inappropriate and bizarre to have a defense attorney threaten you like that. And obviously was reassured that, no, you did this in good faith and you're redacting it as soon as you realize that this was an issue.
Yeah, the whole exchange and the whole fact that they called her, look, she would have been rather have been at the dentist getting four perfectly fine teeth extracted than to be on that witness stand. And that was from the minute she hit the stand. Yeah. She was so visibly irritated. She said, I have no idea why I'm here. I had nothing to do with the case. And of course, he jumped on that. Oh, really? Mm-hmm. You have no idea. Despite our conversation. Oh, you mean the conversation where you were going to accuse me of perjury if I didn't make my testimony what you wanted it to be?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, it was just a very heated and nasty exchange between the two of them.
Yeah, I thought so very much, and including getting to the point where she got, you know, a bit upset, I think, on the stance. And I'm just paraphrasing, but it was something to the effect of my whole career, my livelihood, everything depends on me basically telling the truth on the stand. And I know the defense kind of jumped on that because, it depends on what side you're viewing this from. If one side you consider the truth that she's making something up or doing the right thing or whatever it was phrased as, it versus her just telling what actually happened and just saying, look, this was a false memory. It happens. You can be in a place. I mean, just, I don't know. I remember working in office buildings many years of my life, and you could easily have that of, oh, yeah, well, I thought they were in their office down there, but, oh, maybe it's another day I'm remembering. I mean, it does happen. This is not an impossible thing or something completely insane. It's not the greatest when your memory is being relied upon for very important moments in a case. But at the same point, she didn't even know at the time the importance of any of this. She was just saying what she thought she remembered and then corrected it.
Well, the reason it falls flat, going back to my brick and mortar, there was no way she was there. It was impossible to be there. So it's impossible to have a memory.
Yeah.
So what were they trying to prove? that she initially said something that hurt the case of the CW and then changed it. But there was no possible way she could have known that because it was a falsehood.
Yeah.
Didn't happen. So it fell flat for me. It was just confused.
I'm wondering how frustrated, I mean, you could hear the frustration in Alan Jackson's voice, and I don't blame him. I mean, there's been so many things in this case where I think they feel like, okay, we got something here. This kind of points in the direction of the story that we made up. And then it's like, oh shit, that didn't work out either. or Karen just bombs it herself with her own words. This has got to be a case where they're hitting their heads against brick walls and bricks are continuing to fall on top of the brick wall that they're hitting their heads against on top of other portions of their head. It's just, they can't seem to catch a break here this round.
Well, the whole difference from one to two is the CW last round really did their case for them in an attempt to kind of thwart them being able to do it.
Yeah.
The CW said, okay, we're just going to put on the defense case and try to debunk it as we go. And it was terrible because they never proved their case. Brennan's going in and saying, no, we're proving our case and they can try to prove their case. You know, we're not even going to call Proctor. We're not going to call anyone and they can try to prove it. And now they're left with no one to really call except for a couple of experts and this poor woman. And I do feel bad for her. Like I said, she was so, you know, green and, you know, really made a lot of mistakes early. Even now, I think she has only maybe 2 years under her belt, two to 3 years. You're just figuring out where the bathroom is with 2 or 3 years. You know, every day is a huge learning experience. And she's really had a rough lesson to learn on this one.
Yeah, I would definitely say so. Let's move over to other testimony that we haven't talked about yet since we last spoke. Judson Welcher, I believe he was just taking the stand for his first thing when we were talking previous Wednesday. That it turned out to be quite the testimony. I'm even going to begin with a question, just go to you. What was your reaction to his very articulate and finite testimony about the data that he looked into?
Well, he did such a great job, really. I know a lot of people felt like on cross that he was getting, you know, he and Lessie were going after it, and they were. And he got the best of Lessie, that's for sure. I mean, we all saw the meltdown of Lessie. But back to your question, how about direct testimony? It was so good. It was so solid. I mean, his background was just impeccable in terms of his expertise and, you know, engineering background, everything. So that was good. But what he said to me that was so critical is that the backing event that was registered by Karen Reed's car took place. It took place over 80 feet, which again accounts for moving forward 30, backwards a full 80, which perfectly puts that vehicle in the position to line up with where John O'Keefe's body was. And more importantly, perhaps, was that the time frame that the backing event occurred lined up with John O'Keefe within seconds, John O'Keefe's body never moving again, at least his cell phone, which was in his back pocket, according to the expert, never moved again.
Yeah. Here's something that I, because I listened to, I was driving back from Kansas yesterday. I even texted you over the weekend because I drove by, because I know you're from that area originally too. And I took my daughter by where the BTK house was, because that's a great father-daughter experience. Anyway, I was driving back. Exactly. Park City. It hasn't changed. Drove on the way back listening to 4 hours of the testimony from Friday, was it the 28th or 27th or whatever it was, Friday the 30th. And the whole time, I mean, it was basically a good 4 hours straight of going back and forth with Welcher about the data that he analyzed that was based on going back based on Welcher's testimony with who is the expert that they brought in on the prosecution on Friday? His name, his name escapes me at this second, but
well, Welcher was the prosecution's expert witness, and then he also talked about the other expert that actually broke down the digital, some of the digital timing.
Sure, I'm talking about the defense's witness that came up there.
The defense witness. The defense witness. You're right. His name escapes me too. It was DiGiorno or DiGiorno.
It's not delivery. It's DiGiorno. You're right. It was something of that nature. It just completely escapes me while we're on here live. But anyway, there was just going back and forth for 4 hours about basically a 30-second time window. And at the end of the day in all of this, a 30-second time window is a pretty small space in time. So to me, I mean, the fact that we have the technology to basically figure this down now almost to the exact second, the fact that it's still a 30-ish second time window doesn't really change anything for me. If I were to go see, okay, well, the vehicle does this maneuver and then his phone stops working, basically anywhere within that window to me is telling me, okay, it looks like there's a dead man here and there's taillight embedded in him and the car shows this and the phone shows that. There's nobody else here where this could have happened. Nothing else could have happened here other than that. Just by deduction, it seems that she hit him. I don't know. 30 seconds isn't a big, huge deal to me. Should it be? Because the defense sure seems to want to make it to be.
Well, two things on that. Yeah. First of all, the defense witness did no examination of anything himself. The only thing he examined was a report. This is the number one mistake that you cannot do as a defense or as any sort of expert testimony. You make your own conclusions based on your own experiments, mm-hmm. based on your own reading of the data and information, your own calculations. So he, to me, just did a death drop trying to say he's basing everything on another expert's conclusion. Mm-hmm. By doing that, he's saying, I adopt the expert's conclusions.
Yeah.
And I'm sort of working off that to try to make my own. No, you have to have the original data to make your own. And so he not only took a shortcut, he cheated the path. He never walked the path. He just got to the end and made guesswork of how he got there. Mm-hmm. And you cannot do that as an expert. So that was the first thing that stuck out to me. I was shocked. I've never seen that. Now, this isn't to say lawyers try to get you to do that. Mm-hmm. They say, hey, listen, we have the expert report. Can you look this over and poke holes in it? And the answer is always this: no. I can conduct my own investigation and give you my own conclusions, and that may or may not line up with his or her conclusions, but I have to do this all on my own. I will never take another expert report. And literally, that's expert 101. Mm-hmm. I'm sure they just didn't have the money or they didn't have the time
to
have him do that.
It's not delivery. It's DeSorga, by the way. Matthew DeSorga.
DeSorga.
Yeah, DeSorga. It was close. Yes.
You're going to have to clip out the other.
Yeah, we'll leave it. It is what it is. But it's, so we had all of that coming in on Friday. And I found, I mean, just the, again, conjecture is so interesting in this trial because there's a lot of it. And we see it in a lot of trials, but I feel like there's been a lot of conjecture from witnesses just like speaking out of turn a bit that really are not in the favor of Karen Reed, where it has been, and I didn't have to do any math at all, and he did all the math for me. It's like, aren't you supposed to be doing that to, like, I don't know, just make sure like it's right if you're going to be testifying on it? If you found this error over here, but now you're saying you're just taking his math at will. So which pieces are you picking here and saying, I'm going to double check this, but not this over here? It seemed like a mess. I mean, I know he's an expert witness. I don't know what you know, if it was just like, hey, you know, all we can afford is this, so what do I get for that amount of money? And this is what they got. I don't know, because I think he obviously he was not a cell phone expert either. He knew nothing about iPhones or anything in terms of pulling the data down. He knew about vehicles. So I thought that was also kind of a bizarre little crux. Like, why are you picking this guy who half of the point you're trying to make doesn't have any expertise in?
Tony, I am so glad you pointed that out, because that was the other glaring issue. I mean, he doesn't know anything about cell phone or cell phone times or how to coordinate. He's never, ever coordinated a text stream timing with an iPhone timing. And then he brought in Reed, Reed's phone, which the whole idea was John O'Keefe. When did John O'Keefe's phone stop moving? You know, shut down compared to when the vehicle strike would have happened. The other point was that we all learned that text stream data does not denote a pedestrian strike, only other collisions with vehicles. And I thought that that was very important for all of us to understand. But of course, there was the deceleration, right? Mm-hmm. Which would line up with you've backed up at 75% throttle going almost 24 miles an hour, and now you're stopping, right? Decelerating to move forward and leave.
Yeah.
So I think they still did a good job lining that up with, you know, when the collision would have taken place. And at the end of the day, that's what he said. He said John O'Keefe was hit, his elbow lined up with striking the taillight, and that those cuts were likely from that. So he spells it all out.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and I thought Welcher did a very good job of spelling that out. And I felt it was a rather bizarre rebuttal with the DiSorga. Keep wanting to say DiGiorno. I will be DiSorga. Calling him DiGiorno for the rest of the trial if I have to reference him. it was certainly very fascinating to watch all of that kind of play out. We also, in the trial of Karen Reed here, as we're getting into this next week of testimony with the defense bringing their case in chief, we saw a friend of Proctor take the stand. The argument was made on Friday in voir dire that, hey, maybe it should be Proctor that takes a stand if he's going to be bringing in this information to authenticate these texts. But judge did not agree with the prosecution on that. They agreed with the defense. And so they brought in at least one of the friends to try and authenticate these texts. And, you know, those text messages were pretty damning in the first trial of Karen Reed. They really painted a horrible picture in terms of the image of Michael Proctor. Obviously, yes, there was an investigation done. They found that there was no other ill will things going on here other than it was kind of a sloppy investigation. And he said a bunch of horrible things, to which he was ending up being fired for. How do you think it landed this round, now that Karen's already... I mean, her image is not solid at this point, I think, with that jury. Very different than last time. Do you think we're going to see more about the text messages? Where do you think this all goes? And how do you think it landed with the initial introduction to the jury?
Well, two things, Tony. First of all, I wasn't surprised with Judge Cannone's ruling, because she is always going to err on the side of the defense because she does not want this case overturned. Mm-hmm. And so she's going to give them, and has the whole trial given them, much leeway. Mm-hmm. Having said that, this was, I thought, such solid ground made by Brennan and the prosecution team that you cannot introduce these messages, because they are supposed to speak to the mindset of the person who produced them. And they put on there somebody else who not only didn't write any of them, mm-hmm. didn't even participate in that string, didn't even read these messages, because he was on a string that was 8 years long.
Yeah.
All these people had been, you know, texting and stuff. And sometimes you pay attention, sometimes you don't. You know how it is when you're on these long strings with multiple friends. Mm-hmm. So he wasn't even really involved in it. I don't even know why they picked him. But I was really surprised at Judge Cannone's ruling that he could even introduce them. Then they pared them all down. and barely had any. I mean, I think he read maybe a dozen, maybe, and they weren't even bad. There were a few that, again, were the I think three, you know, bad ones. But because last year they did it all together and they put every one of it, just was so ugly. And Proctor reading them had a whole different way. In fact, this guy, I felt terrible for him when he said, "Judge, I don't feel comfortable reading these. I didn't read them at the time. I don't, you know, please don't make me read them." Essentially, they had a sidebar and Brennan ended up reading them. And then he would just look and say, "Yes."
Yeah, I thought it was interesting hearing Brennan say those words, although he didn't say them all verbatim. He's like, "And the C word." It's like, yep, that we know what the C word is. Yeah, it didn't have the quite the same, you know, verbose feel to it that it did last time with Alan Jackson, you know, repeating them on the stand as Proctor was you know, having to repeat what he wrote. I go back to this, and we talked about it last week a bit, and I'm still not clear. Why does the defense not want to bring Proctor up?
Well, I've been going back and forth with so many people about that all weekend, and essentially, I think Proctor might have a lot to say that he didn't feel comfortable saying as a law enforcement officer, but now he's a civilian, he's been fired, and I think he is ready to swing the bat on different things he saw and read. And, you know, once you get them out of your mouth, the judge can tell the jury not to consider it or to strike it, but you can't unhear it. And I think they were terrified because he knows this case better than anybody.
Yeah.
He's read all the messages. He knows everything that Yannetti said, you know, and I know that's attorney-client privilege, but some of that was waived, as we know, with the ID. That's why they're able to put so much of this on and the attorneys were on. So I think they're terrified about what he's going to say, different conversations were, and that she might have even admitted it on her text strings that she did it. So I think they're terrified of him as a witness. Now you might ask, well, then why didn't the CW put it on? Well, the CW didn't want to muddy and throw through the gutter, you know, their lead investigator, because they would have been able to do it like they did last year, that just made all of us go, "Ooh, this guy should have never said those things." So nobody faltered.
Yeah.
They're not going to put them on.
And that's, yeah, I'm just kind of shocked by that. That, to me, I thought that's going to be their case. That's the place where they can get some reasonable doubt, because I know they're trying to find reasonable doubt in some of these things, but I just don't think any of it's landing. I mean, could you say technical doubt, almost kind of like Judson said, well, yes, there could also, her car could be beamed up into space too. That is a possibility. Is it likely? No. But could you say it's a possibility? Anything's possible. It just feels like none of it's landing. But they went for sympathy last time and empathy. Like, how could someone talk like this about this woman who we didn't hear all of her words from yet? So it landed a lot better. She was just the innocent woman standing there that was many people found attractive, and just, oh my goodness. Now we've heard her words. Now we've seen that same person say all that she's had to say in those documentaries and then some. That Proctor looks very different this time around. Not condoning what he said at all, but he doesn't. He seems like he's not quite the demon he was originally.
Right, he's persona non grata.
Yeah,
I mean, everybody's kind of heard about Proctor. You know, we know a few messages from Proctor, and Brennan did a nice job of getting out. Listen, he was fired, but not for anything egregious. For instance, you know, not for corruption of the case or for planting evidence, nothing like that. It was regarding these text messages, not even for an improper investigation, nothing like that.
Yeah.
It was the text messages and drinking. He didn't get the drinking part out because his friend just said over and over he was fired because the text messages.
Yeah. I mean, and when you think of this, too, I mean, in its totality, if there had been a conspiracy and there was this many people involved in it, there would be evidence. There, I mean, these, look, I mean, much respect to everybody in this, but I mean, these are not, you know, super special CIA agents here who are working, you know, incognito. And these are regular folks who became officers. You know, certainly some have more training than others and more expertise than others. Without a doubt, I'm not in any way trying to play that down. But these are not the folks that are going to pull off a 50-person plus conspiracy and leave no trace. I mean, all we have here is, well, why didn't they look in the house? That's a fair question. You know, was it a dog bite? Well, upon further explanation and examination, doesn't really look like it. I get how on the surface one may look at some of these things and go, well, let's look at this a little bit further. Well, they didn't investigate that. And that's not great. But it also doesn't mean, and logically mean, that all of this could possibly even work. That's at the end of the day what gets me on the whole damn thing. There's no way in hell, Annie, this would be the best conspiracy in the world if all of these people pulled this thing off to this degree of not leaving a single breadcrumb that is extremely incriminating, because there really isn't. There's a lot of things that look weird, but there's nothing here that says, oh my gosh, here's the big evidence of the conspiracy.
Yeah. So the dog bite, if I would have been part of that defense team, I would have said, do not put on the dog bite. There is no canine DNA.
Yeah.
You just have to close that chapter. You have to close it. You could say that the people who killed him scratched him.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you could say that the glass he held when they got into the scuffle, I mean, if you're going to keep with the idea that he was killed inside the house or that he hit something inside the house. But Chloe the dog falls so flat because, again, brick and mortar, no canine DNA.
Yeah.
You know, as far as the people not coming out of the house, they were sound asleep.
Mm-hmm.
Tony, I don't know if you saw when I was at my house in Texas and I was working in the back side of the house and I just happened to go in the kitchen. I look out my front kitchen window and there's Tesla SUV. Mm-hmm. There's police cars everywhere. There's a Hummer. What do you call those? A cement truck, not okay. A Hummer,
yeah.
A cement truck. And there's all this activity. I'm like, oh my gosh, I didn't even hear any of this.
Mm-hmm.
I walk outside and sure enough, this was when the Teslas were being attacked. A cement truck hit a Tesla. And then they had a high speed chase, which ended at my neighborhood because we live on the cul-de-sac.
Mm-hmm.
The guy jumps out, jumps the fence. Everyone in this police department was out there. I mean, it was Grand Central Station. Never heard a thing. And I was wide awake,
mm-hmm.
Only, you know, a few, whatever yards, probably 30 yards from my kitchen window until I looked out.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, these guys were sound asleep. They went to bed past 2 to 3 in the morning. And this was now, you know, 6 in the morning. They were sound asleep. And everybody seems to have a problem with that. Even when Jim McCabe went and tried to rouse them and made a call, they didn't hear anything because they were sound asleep.
I get that.
Neither did other neighbors.
I do get that, but that is a weird part to me on all of this is that the fact that it could initially sound asleep. Sure. Of course. I'm talking like when you have all the activity in the yard and all this is going on and you are wakened by Jen McCabe. I guess, I don't know, why didn't anybody go out? That's the part I don't get. I don't get why nobody...
They weren't awakened. They were never awakened. They weren't awake. She never got them to wake up. She never got them to answer the door, never got them to answer the phone.
But
so they were never awake.
There's no point that they were awake at the... I mean, this that was going on well into the morning.
Not until later.
Wow.
They were, I mean, really, it's 6 in the morning and you're out till 2 in the evening. Talks about that, and they were drinking heavily, heavily all day. Remember, he had been at a funeral. Mm-hmm. So he got up early, drove all the way to New York, mm-hmm. went to a funeral, which is exhausting, and somebody you cared about, and drive all the way back in a snowstorm. And then go out and drink all night.
Yeah.
I mean, he was dead to the world, I think. And then actually he talked about in the first trial how after they went to bed, then they had a, you know, sexual interaction. Mm-hmm. So he was really exhausted, Tony.
You know,
there
is more of a human inner aspect of it. That's why I wanted to throw that by you, because I throw these questions by everybody where I'm like, this does seem weird on either side. And because I want to hear, OK, right. Well, what's the reasoning behind that? And then sometimes it's like, oh, I can kind of understand that. I've been dead to the world a few times, you know, after an evening like that in some younger years. It's been a while, but I do remember some of that. and I don't want to, but I do. So, yeah, there's that. There's another aspect of this I want to talk about briefly. And that's where I'm going. This could be the biggest twist in the whole damn case. And that would be the blogger. Who's been, you know, 1,000%, you know, or more, I would say, at an obsessive level supporting Karen Reed. Now, you know, shit's hitting the fan. And now there's some pretty strong charges that he's very likely going to be going away on. Do you think, is it even a possibility that they would offer him some sort of a plea deal to testify against Karen?
Well, I think there's a lot of factors here. First of all, this trial will conclude before his begins. Now, he has a misdemeanor trial date set up for, I believe it's June 9th, right around the corner here. But that's a misdemeanor on, you know, not staying out of the area of somebody that he had a restraining order, that had a restraining order against him. I mean, he's literally lurking in the bushes and they catch him on video. So he's going to be convicted of that. But that's a misdemeanor. Mm-hmm. It's these other big felony charges that are daunting. And his attorney, Bradel, I think, is finally being pretty candid with him, saying you could go to prison for up to 10 plus years on these. Actually, his exposure is much more than that. I don't think he'd get any more than that. And I think he said it himself. Said, I'm going to have to listen to what they have to say. I want to stay out. But if this is decided and if she's convicted, I don't think the Commonwealth will, or I think the Commonwealth will not budge. Mm-hmm. They want to see him go to prison too for what he's done. Mm-hmm. But if she's acquitted or if there's a hung jury, mm-hmm. could that become more interesting? Then I think it becomes interesting, Tony.
Yeah.
Because, you know, he could, and just think, I mean, there were lots of conversations with Yannetti and Jackson as well. And they never represented him. Mm-hmm. So what could come out? What all does he know, Tony?
Yeah.
I would love to see it. I hope he snitches them all out. He, to me, is low-hanging fruit. Mm-hmm. He's a puppet. On their strings. And, you know, I hope he turns the tables on him.
I think it'd be very interesting if he did. I've been kind of surprised by some of the statements that I've seen coming out from him, just kind of been a little bit more in tune with reality than I think most of the people who follow him, of just kind of seeing, I think, some of the writing on the wall. That's my interpretation of how some of the comments that he's made about this of yes, like I'd take a plea deal. I'd figure this out. I'd do what I have to do. If they want me to say this or that, like, oh, like you mean like talk about what in reality is going on here. My conjecture is I think deep down he knows that this is an act that he's put on. He got way too deep in. He could not get out of it. And now this is not going to end well for him. But he's got kids that he's, you know, allegedly cares about, you know, likes to throw them out there as a, you know, woe me thing. But for the sake of the kids, I'm like, I hope he goes away, because that would probably be much better for them in the long term to not have that as a constant factor in your life, as this is how one should live. But on the part of getting, you know, of Karen Reed being convicted, I can only imagine what he would have or what would be on record in any of his devices or just him testifying as to their strategies on this. What do you think? I mean, I really wonder what he could possibly have, what he could possibly do. And do you think it's a realistic possibility that he could play a part in this specific case, Karen Reed trial 2, not the possible, you know, threequel and the fourquel that could possibly come out of all of this?
I don't think he's going to play a role here because we're so deep into trial. I mean, really, we're looking at maybe three witnesses that are left, maybe four. I mean, we're really deep, of course, with Alessi becoming the face of the Karen Reed campaign now and Alan Jackson taking such a minor role. Of course, it's extended because Alessi's style is very verbose. And elongated, so everything lasts a lot longer. But this trial is almost over, and I don't think any decisions will be made until this trial is over. But what he can, I think, bring fresh is the bringing her into the conspiracy, and maybe Yannetti and maybe Jackson into a conspiracy regarding the witness tampering and harassment. Was he directed to do that? Was there a quid pro quo? In other words, the Lexus, which remember the brother worked at a Lexus dealership, was that part of the payment for what he's doing? And then we all know there was merchandising and other things that they were supposedly splitting, but then he got on record and said, well, we're not splitting anything. I'm getting it all. So he could paint that picture, I think, more clear and be backed up and substantiated by the third party witness, Natalie, who was the go-between for a while, and then directly with Karen Reed, Yannetti, and Jackson. We know there's all these phone calls. And he could also testify to whatever he says was a part of Signal. You know, we don't have Signal records, so he can basically say anything. You know, and so, but I, will it affect this trial? I don't think so. I think that would come in a separate case.
Because it's the gift that keeps on giving. This thing does not end. ARCA, that's going to be interesting to see. They're going to give their take on all this. How well do you think that will stand up compared to the other testimony that we saw from Judson and company?
Well, I think the issue is going to be that, first of all, did they have time to do the appropriate experiments they should do based on what Welcher said? Remember, she gave them only, I want to say, a week. I don't know any expert that can do all of that in a week's time or so.
Yeah.
You'd have to work day and night and have 20 people working with you and to write a report and do all that. So I don't know if they were able to really do the testing or if they just, again, did what DiGiorno did. I know it's not DiGiorno, and just say, well, listen, they're saying this and relying on their words and their experiments. If they do that, I think it's going to fall flat. But the biggest problem I think is going to be is on the heels of the woman that said they tried to coerce her not to tell the truth. When all that nastiness comes in, which Canone said, I am giving you big latitude. She pointed that out to Brennan to go after them for not being honest in the first trial and to the court. I think it's going to look really bad for the defense.
There's a lot in here that is putting a lot of doubt in the not reasonable doubt for Karen Reed, but putting a lot of doubt into the legitimacy of the Karen Reed defense in terms of trusting them on anything they're presenting when we're getting just flat out down to the like the damning testimony that we saw today by their own witness about the threats of you're going to go after you for perjury and all of that. It's not a good look in front of that jury. I don't know what's going to save them at this point. I'm. Are you surprised at how well the prosecution is doing this case? I mean, I expected them to do well, but in my opinion, it just feels like this is not working for Karen at all. I was expecting a little more neck and neck on this, but my read is that it's not feeling that way.
You know, in really researching Brennan before the trial began, I thought, wow, this guy is going to be good. I mean, anytime you wore the defense hat as well as he wore that, that's why he's such a great cross-examiner. You know, he's just so adept at it. The other thing is he has made himself the key figure for the prosecution throughout this whole process. Mm-hmm. So I think the jury, I think probably has developed some sort of connection with him. Mm-hmm. He's so easy to follow, so to the point. He's sparred a little bit, mm-hmm. but nothing condescending and really ugly. Where he's seen Jackson get ugly, they've seen Alessi come completely unhinged.
Yeah.
You know, he's saying that I'm making hand motions and I'm not judge. Then she says, what? Let him answer. But judge, he's saying I'm doing something and I'm not. And then the judge says, Alessi, please.
Yeah.
You know, it was such a bad moment for the defense.
It was. I'm kind of stunned by this. But again, this is, I think, speaking to just everybody's human in this. And they have got to be frustrated as hell. Just every corner they turn, even if they've made some runs here, then all of a sudden they turn around and there's Karen saying something else, whether it be in video from years ago or walking outside the courtroom that same damn day. I am kind of legitimately wondering, is it just like this, let her hang herself? Just, we're going to do our job. We're going to show that we defended this as best we could. But at the end of the day, you can't stop her from hanging herself, because that seems to be what she continues to do every time she talks, every time she says something outside the courthouse. She contradicts herself within the same sentence sometimes. It's kind of stunning.
Yeah, and you know, when you look at Karen Reed compared to last trial, in that trial, she was walking on sunshine.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when she left the courtroom, when she was in the courtroom. And now you see her, you know, I watch her when I watch the trial. I always watch the Karen cam next to it,
mm-hmm.
to see what her reactions are to the witnesses. And for instance, right now, just glancing over here, seeing the Dr. Russell, their dog bite expert, testify. She is a wilted flower. AJ seems to be more concerned about his text messages mm-hmm. that are coming in. It's crazy how checked out AJ seems and how deflated Karen seems.
Mm-hmm.
And it's such a different look. And it's because they don't have the upper hand this trial. They had the upper hand last trial.
Yeah. And it's been evident from the start. The dog bite expert, is on there right now, or I said that in air quotes, really. She was giving out some very interesting numbers about just how many dog bites she had seen. And you were doing some research on that. You want to speak to that at all?
Oh, yeah. She's had two voir dires,
mm-hmm.
One last year, one this year, and testified. So I have been able to watch all three
mm-hmm.
in full. And her contradictions between bites and scratches and her exaggerations of how many dog bites, wounds she has examined was jaw-dropping. And at the time, you know, I was writing on Twitter hoping the CW is monitoring my tweets,
mm-hmm.
Saying, you have got to go pull that, because she gives very specific dates that she purportedly worked at these establishments,
mm-hmm.
and very specific timeframes. And all that information about dog bites, dog bite wounds, anybody who dog from a dog bite is all readily available. So mm-hmm. as an example, her last job she had was at a prison, physician at a prison, which, by the way, working in and around prisons, visiting these inmates, being in and out of them, is the worst job. I can't imagine any physician that wants to give up a posh, wonderful clinical or hospital type
mm-hmm.
address for a prison.
Yeah,
I always say prisons smell like a cross between kitty litter and BO and bleach.
Which
so every
actually,
day you walk into it.
That's a new scent I saw at Bath & Body for the season. It's one of those new spring scents. It's, yeah.
Been to prison. Yeah. I mean, I always just got myself prepared when I walked in there. And that's what you're giving up for that. But anyway, she talks about dog bites there. She talked about examining at least 1,000 dog bites in one place, but she lowered it to 500 just to be careful. I'm like, you should not, as an expert, be throwing numbers out like that. Mm-hmm. When you do your CV, which her CV didn't even involve dog bite expert, right? She did one small paper, which I also posted on Twitter. It's a very easy and short read, and it has nothing to do with civilian dogs. And it was written eons ago. Mm-hmm. I mean, the dog bites she examined, she didn't even use DNA.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's so incredible that she's just discounting the DNA. She said today, I believe, that dogs don't always leave DNA. And like, how can you possibly say such a ludicrous statement?
Dogs don't always leave DNA.
Now,
really?
Now we'll have to look at the exact one because I've been on here with you, but I was reading, you know, there's a teleticker and like, did she really just say that? Oh my gosh. So, you know, there's big problems with inflating her numbers that she's examined. I looked and I believe it was from 17 to 2023, the total amount of dog bite incidents in incarcerated people was 295 incidents. Mm-hmm. Yet she is giving inflated numbers on how many she examined at the prison that she was at. She also gave, I thought, inflated numbers on how many deaths. She said that she examined, which totally had nothing to do with her expertise for this trial. 60 people died in her prison in a short amount of time. I'm like, 60 people died in that prison? That's the kind of stuff Brennan needs to have an analyst go look up, because it's going to be easily found, how many people died at that prison during that date range. 60 seems over the top.
It all seemed like high numbers. I mean, I'm not an expert in any of that. So it's sometimes you get surprised. You're like, oh, wow, I didn't know that that number is. But the numbers seemed very high on everything that she was saying. It's like, why? And why are you having that many dog bite incidents in the prison to begin with? Like, are the dogs just like, are they out there in the yard? And it's just like, hey, go get them like every day? Or what the hell is going on here? Because if you're having that many dog bite incidents, I think there might be a problem with the prison.
Yeah, that's why it just doesn't make sense when you look at the numbers. And I think it won't make sense. And I hope they went back and looked at the ERs that she looked at. How many times did people really come in with dog bites? Thousands? I'm not buying it.
I don't know. It's certainly data to look into and would be very interesting to hear what that would sound like if she's challenged on it, which maybe is happening as we're talking. I wonder if it's, I'll give a tit for tat here. If she's like, oh, that number was wrong. It was, I meant to say this or that. Okay, fine. Then as long as you correct it, if it is in fact wrong, but it does seem a bit off. She seems like a lovely woman that you meet in a coffee shop, hear some fantastical stories, go home and Google and go, oh, holy shit, that person was really, they were telling some stories, but I could be wrong. I don't know. All right. There we are. Jennifer Coffendaff, a retired FBI special agent. As always, thank you for your insight into the case that is Karen Reed.
Thank you, Tony.
Drivers who switch and save with Progressive could save hundreds. With that kind of money, you could go big time on a fancy water bottle with ultra titanium alloy metal. You're not sure why you need all that. I mean, it just holds water. But you're getting it anyway. Because if you're hiking near an active volcano and you accidentally drop the bottle into molten lava, your water will still be icy cold. Switch to Progressive and you could save big time. For water bottles. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Not available in all states. Potential savings will vary.
You've done it again, finance teams. You closed the books, and it went fine. Sure, some expenses were missing receipts, but that's fine. Stayed late to process invoices by hand. It's all fine. But don't you deserve better than fine? With Ramp, expenses are submitted with a text, invoices are coded automatically, and everything is connected to your accounting system, so you can close the books without all the busy work. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.
Drivers who switch and save with Progressive could save hundreds. With that kind of money, you could go big time on a fancy water bottle
with ultra-titanium alloy metal.
You're not sure why you need all that. I mean, it just holds water. But you're getting it anyway. Because if you're hiking near an active volcano and you accidentally drop the bottle into molten lava, your water will still be icy cold. Switch to Progressive and you could save big time. For water bottles. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and affiliates not available in all states. Potential savings will vary. Drivers who switch and save with Progressive could save hundreds. With that kind of money, you could go big time on a fancy water bottle
with ultra-titanium alloy metal.
You're not sure why you need all that. I mean, it just holds water. But you're getting it anyway. Because if you're hiking near an active volcano and you accidentally drop the bottle into molten lava, your water will still be icy cold. Switch to Progressive and you could save big time for water bottles. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and affiliates not available in all states. Potential savings will vary. Drivers who switch and save with Progressive could save hundreds. With that kind of money, you could go
big time
on a fancy water bottle
with ultra-titanium alloy metal.
You're not sure why you need all that. I mean, it just holds water.
But you're getting it anyway. Because if you're hiking near an active volcano and you accidentally drop the bottle into molten lava, your water will still be icy cold. Switch to Progressive and you could save
big time for water bottles. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and affiliates not available in all states. Potential savings will vary. Drivers who switch and save with Progressive could save hundreds. With that kind of money, you could go
big time
on a fancy water bottle
with ultra-titanium alloy metal.
You're not sure why you need all that. I mean, it just holds water.
But you're getting it anyway. Because if you're hiking near an active volcano and you accidentally drop the bottle into molten lava, your water will still be icy cold. Switch to Progressive and you could save
big time for water bottles. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and affiliates not available in all states. Potential savings will vary. Drivers who switch and save with Progressive could save hundreds. With that kind of money, you could go
big time
on a fancy water bottle
with ultra-titanium alloy metal.
You're not sure why you need all that. I mean, it just holds water.
But you're getting it anyway. Because if you're hiking near an active volcano and you accidentally drop the bottle into molten lava, your water will still be icy cold. Switch to Progressive and you could save
big time for water bottles. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and affiliates not available in all states. Potential savings will vary.